Welcome to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, right here on Kanza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, the host of Andrew's Answers, and we're here to answer your questions about life and to talk about topics of interest in mental health. Let me just mention that when we talk about answers to life's questions, all statements are intended to be helpful in a general way, and answers are of a general nature. They are not intended to take the place of personal counseling or input from a mental health professional with whom you would work directly. You can send us questions by email at answers, that's A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at andrewsinc.net, that's andrewsinc.net. You can also follow me on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, R-U-S-T-Y-A-N-D-R-E-W-S. And you can check us out at the Kanza Internet Radio website at kanzaradio.org. That's K-O-N-Z-A-radio.org. We thank you for listening today, and thank you for the questions that have been sent in by email. We will always change the names on emails that are sent to us, so you don't have to worry about you being personally identified if we use your question on the air. So thanks for those questions, and we're going to get to those questions here in the second portion of our show. But today I wanted to replay an earlier interview that we had with a person who was at the time a member of the staff at Andrews and Associates and who has since moved to a position working at Fort Riley with the soldiers there. And she is talking about the topic of grief and how to deal with grief. This is Dr. Stephanie Wick, who is a certified grief counselor and is also a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of Kansas. And we want to talk a little bit about grief and how to deal with it and how to help people who are dealing with grief. Now I'd like to bring in an associate of mine at Andrews and Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, Dr. Stephanie Wick. And Dr. Wick is an expert in working with grief, and welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And I thought maybe we could just start with you saying just a few words about dealing with grief. In our society, dealing with grief is something that we apparently don't do a very good job of.
I think that would be a fair statement. In the society we live, it's really a death-phobic society. Most of us don't like to think about our deaths and become very uncomfortable at the topic of death. And so in doing so, we don't really know how to deal with it when it does happen in our families or in our friend groups or in the people that we know, with the people that we know. So in saying that, there's oftentimes I get questions about, am I doing this right? What does grief look like? What should it look like? Am I doing it wrong? And the answer to those questions is that there is no right or wrong way to do it, that everybody does it differently. For some people, it will last for months. For others, it will last perhaps a year, 2 years, 3 years. Some people, it may last a couple weeks. As far as what you can expect while you're grieving, again, you can expect just about anything. Emotionally, you can feel like you're on a roller coaster, and you can be happy 1 minute and sad the next. You can feel hopeless and helpless at the same time, a sense of longing, confusion. Behaviorally, you may experience a lack of appetite, inability to sleep, sleeping too much, eating too much, stomach aches, fatigue. Cognitively, psychologically, you may have difficulty concentrating, focusing. You may have difficulty managing multiple tasks at a time. You may feel confused. May have difficulty doing things that you may have once done prior to the loss. And socially, again, you can. There may be a tendency to withdraw. There may be a need to reach out to people and to seek support from other people, to widen your support group so that you feel like you're not doing this alone. Grief is a very isolating experience when you go through it. It's normal to feel as though you're the only one who's ever felt this and that no one else can fully understand what you're going through. The sensation that your world has stopped and everyone else is just flying by you. And that's something that I hear a lot with the people that I talk with is everybody else's life is moving on. Mine has stopped. What's wrong with this? How do I get moving forward again?
And it sounds, as you describe this reaction that people have when they're going through grief, it sounds very much like depression.
There can be moments of depression. However, it's different than depression. There are other elements to grief that you wouldn't normally experience during depression. There are times when grief can develop into more complicated forms where depression is really serious. But when you're grieving, it's expected that you will have moments of depression, that you will have moments where you feel really down and that you feel hopeless and you question what the future is going to look like. And that's normal.
And so people should expect that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People should expect that as well as a number of other things. They should expect that at times they might get angry. They should expect that at times they may have moments of joy, and those moments of joy, at least in the initial phases, may be very quickly followed up with a feeling of guilt, guilty that I'm laughing. How can I be laughing in a time like this? Mm-hmm. Very normal.
Mm-hmm. And do you find in your work that there are people who expect that grief should be done quickly, or that somehow or other they're doing better if they're never sad, or those kinds of things?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that's a conversation I have with everyone that I meet with. There's this idea, particularly in our society, that grief should look a certain way, and that is usually that it lasts a certain amount of time and that you're crying and you're upset. And if you're not doing these things, somehow you're doing it wrong. One of the conversations that I usually have with people is, what are your expectations about grief?
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect that you should be crying and unable to get out of bed, that you should be sad all the time? And if that's what you expect, how is your actual grieving process comparing to that? And oftentimes we hold ourselves to these standards. We expect that we should be doing it a certain way, or expect that others should be doing it a certain way. And when we're not, or others aren't doing it that way, we assume something's wrong, which is almost never the case.
Absolutely. Well, very good. Very helpful information. And I completely understand the concept that in our society we tend to avoid grief. We avoid those who are grieving. And not everyone, but we just don't know what to do. And in fact, that is a question that was tweeted to us earlier, which the writer says, I want to be helpful to my sister whose husband just died, but I don't know what to do. Can you help? And I'm sure that a lot of times you meet with people who are experiencing grief, but also you could be helpful to people who are trying to be helpful to the people who are experiencing grief. So what would you tell her?
Mm-hmm. Watching someone else you love go through the grieving process is extremely difficult, and it's an extremely helpless feeling because there is a realization that you can't fully take that person's pain away. And it's difficult to sit back and watch this person hurt and ache and know that no matter what you do, no matter how many hours you spend with that person, you can't take that away. My advice in that case is that you shouldn't take it away. That it's not your right to take a person's grief away, because grief is a process, and it's a healthy process, and it's a process that everyone has to go through in their own way and in their own time. And it's not our right to try to take that away. As much as we want to take that pain away, it's not our right. It's a process that has to be done in an individual person's individual way. With that said, there are some things that you can do to feel like you are helping out in a practical way. And I'll talk first about what you should do, and I'll talk next about what you should not do.
Okay, because I'm sure there are both.
Yes.
Yeah.
What you can do, we underestimate the value of just being a presence. And oftentimes we feel uncomfortable silence with words, and sometimes they're helpful words and sometimes they're not helpful words. My first piece of advice is just be present. Just be a shoulder to cry on, be a presence. If you recall earlier, I mentioned how isolating grief can be and how you feel like everyone else is moving forward. It's nice to have someone stop and just be with you and just be present. Secondly, help out in practical ways, particularly right after the loss. Get groceries, help plan the funeral if you're that close, help take care of children, help run errands, take care of some of those things. Help out in a practical way.
Mm-hmm.
what you shouldn't do, I mentioned, don't take their grief away. Don't say, I understand what you're going through. Don't try to give lots of advice about how they should be doing it. Mm-hmm. Be okay with the person being really angry one minute and really sad the next. Don't judge them based on what your expectations are of what grief should look like. Give them time. Give them space when they need it. Be there when they ask you to be there, even if it's sitting in silence for hours. Don't avoid talking about the person who's died. So mm-hmm. use the person's name in conversations. Tell stories. There's a tremendous value in knowing that a person's legacy or memory continues beyond their death. And telling stories and using their name is a way for that loved one to know that that person hasn't been forgotten. Mm-hmm. That although they have to move on, this person was still an important part of their life, and that they can remember this person through stories and through the memories that they have.
And I know you can't say specifically about a specific case, but in general, are there things that a person would look at and say, I'm concerned that maybe this person isn't dealing with this in an appropriate manner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the obvious ones, like overusing drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Is that a common thing for people going through grief? And
it can be. I wouldn't say that most people do it. Mm-hmm. But if complications arise, drugs and alcohol can be one way mm-hmm. to help self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And another obvious sign would be any indications of suicide or self-harm. Okay, those are red flags. The not-so-subtle cues would be someone who completely refuses help, mm-hmm. who says they can do this on their own. They don't need help. They don't need people to talk to them. They don't need anyone helping out with the housework. They can do it on their own. That would be a red flag for me. Mm-hmm. Anyone who is isolating, extreme isolation, they're not getting out of the house. Mm-hmm. They're not letting people in the house. They've completely cut themselves off from any social support they may have had. That would be a red flag. That may be an indication of some deeper depression. That goes beyond what normal grief would look like.
It kind of ties together, as I listen to you talk, this whole concept of not stealing someone's grief from them, that it is a process and it's going to include all of those emotions and sometimes no emotion, and that people can try to steal it from someone who's grieving, but the grieving person can also, because of their own expectations, sort of steal it from themselves and deny themselves the opportunity to actually experience that, work through the process, and then feel like there's changes in their lives where they're feeling better.
Yes, and that's something I hear a lot, is I don't want to burden anyone with this. Everyone mm-hmm. else's lives are moving forward. I don't want to burden anyone with my pain. And yes, it's exactly what you're referring to. They have an expectation that they should be able to do this on their own, and mm-hmm. they don't want to bother anyone else with what's going on with their life. There is this recognition that no matter what anybody does, it's not going to bring the person back and it's not going to take the pain away. So oftentimes, yes, I will talk with people who have kind of thrown their hands up and said, I'll do this on my own. I don't need the help. Fortunately, they're in talking with me. So that's one outlet. That's one extra source of support.
Positive. But at least for a small time of the week. But then they do need other people around them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of why people do avoid others? Is it the I just don't want to talk about it thing? Or does it really just come back to I just want to almost pretend that these emotions aren't here, and when I'm talking to people, I can't stop them?
When you're when referring to people who are outside the situation, friends mm-hmm. or family who are not as immediately connected to the loss, mm-hmm. most often what I hear is, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. There's this fine line you walk between saying something and upsetting the person further, or not saying something and upsetting the person further, because mm-hmm. you're not acknowledging the loss. Mm-hmm. The best suggestion would be, if you don't know what to say, say something. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what to say, say I'm sorry. And all you have to say is I'm sorry for your loss. What that does is it acknowledges the loss. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to step too far out your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. We are uncomfortable with death. Most of us are unsure how to help someone. We don't know what to mm-hmm. say. Oftentimes we'll say, I understand. mm-hmm. or they're in a better place. Mm-hmm. All these things are that are very well intentioned that are actually received very differently by the person who's grieving. Mm-hmm.
So that simple "I'm sorry" says "I'm here," and really, I care, and that's mm-hmm. it. And that's really all you're suggesting people do, at least at the beginning.
Yes.
If they don't know what else to do.
Yes. Say "I'm sorry" and be a presence.
Yeah. Well, very good advice. Well, we will also talk about this issue further in later programs, but that is an excellent quick review of how to be helpful and how to deal with grief. And we thank Dr. Stephanie Wick for her participation today. We want to say thank you to Stephanie for participating with us in that interview. And we're going to take a break now and then come back and answer some of life's questions. Remember, you can send us an email and get questions on the air by sending them to answers@andrewsinc.net. This is Dr. Rusty Andrews, and this is Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered, right here on Kansa Internet Radio.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I'm 19 years old, and this is how I live United. I've always been kind of a computer geek, and I found a way to use those skills to help the homeless in my community. For people facing hard times, computer skills and a basic resume are so important. It may seem like a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in people's lives. So with United Way, I created a program where I work with the homeless. Together, we go through their whole job history, write a resume, and then save it on their very own USB drive. We provide workbooks and training certificates. I even budgeted for cupcakes so we can celebrate as a class when one of our people gets a job. That's huge. When somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." That's what living United feels like to me. My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I love it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Kansa Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews of Andrews & Associates Counseling in Manhattan, Kansas, and I'm your host for Andrews Answers. Today we want to answer some questions that have been sent to us by email at answers@andrewsinc.net. And the first one was submitted by a lady named Frances. And in fact, it kind of has a little bit to do with what we were talking about with Dr. Stephanie Wick a little bit earlier. Frances writes, "My best friend just lost her job due to downsizing, no fault of her own. She had been there for 12 years, and she is acting like someone in her family just died. How do I get her to snap out of it?" Well, the reason that I mentioned that this question is related to what Stephanie was talking about earlier is that the topic of grief doesn't just have to do with people who have passed away. Grief is about any kind of loss. That loss can be the loss of a job. It can be the even the loss of of a place where you live, if you move from one town to another, doesn't necessarily even have to be because of something that has happened bad. For instance, you may get a new job and are leaving the old job that you liked and you enjoyed and you did for several years, and there's still grief associated with the loss of that job. It's certainly a happy time when you're going on to a new job and you're excited about it and you're looking forward to it, but there's still a sense of loss that comes from the change that occurred and the stress that occurs because of that change. So grief is not just an issue that has to do with death, the death of someone in your family, the death of a pet, the death of a friend. It has to do with losses of all different kinds. And Frances, your friend has lost her job. It was probably a shock to her. My guess is that if it was because of downsizing, there may have been some rumors that had occurred at the office place that perked people's ears up as folks were talking about problems maybe the company was having. But my my guess would be that when she finally found out that she was losing her job, it still came as quite a shock to her. That means that she would go through many of the same kinds of feelings associated with grief from loss by death that anybody would have in a situation like that, that shock and that sense of disbelief, and then worrying about what's going to happen to her. So she definitely has had a sense of loss, and she is going through a grieving process that while she may have great prospects for another job in the future, she may already be looking at what she could be doing in the future, still is suffering from the grief associated with that loss. So I think that's the first important thing to recognize, is the fact that the reason that she's acting like somebody just died is that for her emotionally, at least on some level, it is very, very similar to that. And so your question of how do I get her to snap out of it is maybe should be thought of as how can you be helpful to her. And maybe it isn't necessarily true that you want her to snap out of it. Grief isn't something that we should just swallow and hold back and not deal with. As a matter of fact, there are many occasions where people try to hold those emotions back, hold their emotions back, whether it's grief or some other kind of emotion. And in doing so and trying to push those down, it actually makes the situation worse. Now, I'm not saying that the most appropriate thing to do whenever you have any emotion is just to express it without regard to the situation that you're in or the person that you're relating to at the moment. But a permanent state of trying to hold those emotions back, a la John Wayne or some other fictional character that we've seen, that tough guy approach, can lead to those emotions sneaking out in other perhaps somewhat negative ways. As a matter of fact, people that work with folks on anger management will oftentimes say that the anger is actually just simply a cover-up for some other emotion, sadness, grief, sense of loss, sense of embarrassment, sense of something else, some other emotion that a person is feeling, and they've tried so hard to cover it up that it's sneaking out in other ways, and it oftentimes sneaks out in expressions of anger. So getting her to snap out of it may not be necessarily the most appropriate way to go with your friend, Frances, because snapping out of it may not be exactly what she needs. Being there and being available to her to talk about her job loss and how she's feeling about it would be a very, very positive thing that you could do. And I would encourage you when you are talking to her to not feel like you need to take on a sense of how you're going to fix her situation, how you're going to make it better for her. Quite likely what she most needs, particularly if she's dealing with the sense of loss or the grief that she has over losing her job is not somebody who's going to tell her what to do, who's going to, at some level, take over her life and make it better for her. But she really just needs somebody to talk to her, or just to listen, I should say, actually more appropriately, to listen to her talk about her own feelings. And as she does that, she is expressing those feelings and being supported in the act of expressing those feelings, and in the expression of them, then she is actually dealing with them. It is helpful most of the time to talk about something with someone that you trust and that you have faith in, that will be there to be supportive of you and to listen to you. So I think that's probably the number one best thing that you can do. I have heard people say, well, you know, if I sit and listen to her, she's just going to, she'll never get over it, because every time she talks about it, it just is re-experiencing it. And I think you can be led by your friend's desire to talk to you. If she knows that you're available to talk to and you truly do make yourself available to talk to, that it's probably not going to be something like that. It's not going to be something that lasts for weeks and weeks and weeks or months and months. It's just something that is there for a time or there for a season, and it will be better for her once she talks it through. Again, not with you trying to come up with some answers, but just there to listen to her. There is something about the way our brains work that as we talk things through and say them out loud, we process them differently than we do when we're just thinking about them. So if you lay in bed and think about something at night, then you're using one part of your brain. But if you speak it out loud, then you use a slightly different part of your brain, and you have to process that information differently. And that's one of the reasons, for instance, that therapists will often talk to clients about journaling about their feelings or writing down how they feel about things, because that is yet another part of the brain that gets used when you're actually having to put your feelings, put your thoughts into words and write them down. The physical act of writing them down requires a different kind of brain processing. So your friend, as she sits and talks to you, is processing that information in a different way than she does when she's just sitting and stewing about it, sitting at home by herself. And that can be very, very helpful. It's amazing to me, and makes my job fairly easy as a therapist, that oftentimes people will sit in my office and talk something through, and maybe that's the first time they've ever had the opportunity to verbalize something. And then they, after they get finished talking about it, I've not really said anything, and all of a sudden they're starting to come up with answers to their own questions about life or the situation that they're in. And I'm just encouraging them to continue thinking about it, and almost like magic, it doesn't take too long before all of a sudden they're thinking about how they ought to act. They get up and tell me thank you, and I'm I'm tempted to just say, you know, I really didn't do anything. But in fact, being there to be supportive and a listening ear can be a very, very, very powerful influence on someone. And Francis, I think maybe that would be the best way to help your friend, is just to be there. And what I mean by that is not just to say, hey, look, if you want to talk, I'm there, but actually maybe taking the initiative and saying, hey, let's go to coffee and sit and, you know, let's just have a visit and go with her, specifically schedule something. You know, people are always saying to folks in grief that, you know, if there's anything I can do, let me know. And, I truly believe that most of the time those people are actually, they truly mean what they say. And if the person who's suffering from that particular grief were to call them up or let them know that they needed something, that, you know, that person would be very quick to do that. But when you're suffering from grief, it is difficult oftentimes to reach out. And sometimes you need somebody just to go ahead and schedule some time to be together. And then if the person who's experiencing the grief wants to talk about it, you invite them to do it, and you're right there. And if they're willing to, if they wish to, then they can. As opposed to just simply saying, you know, look, if you want to talk, give me a call. Because it's hard to do that. Hard to do that thing. People are sometimes embarrassed because of the feelings that they're having. They feel overwhelmed by those feelings, and they really need people to just step up and step in and help them out. I also wanted to mention in relation to this question, Francis, that the whole issue of, and not saying this is necessarily about you, but the whole issue of why we don't like dealing with someone else's pain, I think that part of it is that we get the sense that that pain that is in that other person, I don't want to deal with it because we possibly don't have good emotional boundaries ourselves, and so their pain becomes our pain. If you were talking to your best friend, Frances, about her loss of job, and she was starting to cry about worrying about what was going to happen to her in the future, I could imagine that perhaps that might raise a level of anxiety within you, that sense of, or that feeling of, well, what do I do now, or how can I help her? I just don't know what to do. And I think that sometimes the reason that we avoid people that are experiencing pain is because we don't want to deal with our own anxiety. And so our attempts to say, well, you just need to get over it, or you just need to snap out of it, or, you know, look, it's not that bad, or saying things like, well, it'll be okay, or whatever, really we're not really saying that to the other person. We're really trying to convince ourselves that it'll be okay, and we're trying to stop the pain that we're feeling, the anxiety that we're experiencing from dealing with this person who is in pain. And of course, then that removes us from the ability to actually be there and be present with them, and be there for them and be able to help them just simply by listening. But if we can come to the conclusion personally that regardless of anything else that we might do, that perhaps the most important thing that we can do is just to show that we care, and show that we care by being willing to be there with them in their pain, so that that literally they are not feeling that pain alone. I think that will be very, very, very helpful. If you think about times in your own life when you've had great pain, it's probably not so much the case that the person who told you what to do was the person who had the most impact. It was probably the person who you just knew you could count on, and what you meant by knowing I can count on them was that they were there and they were willing to listen and they were willing to sit with you while you were in that pain. If we as human beings can become able to experience or recognize or see someone's, acknowledge someone's pain without it becoming ours, then we become much more able to be there with them. And really that dynamic that I just described in that one sentence is at the core of what it means to be in any of the helping professions, and that is to be able to be with someone who's experiencing pain and not take that pain on, and yet still empathize with it and be able to respond to them. And again, it's a safe way to respond by just being there to listen to her. So, Francis, I hope that that is helpful for you, and I hope that you'll be able to be helpful to your best friend after she's lost her job due to downsizing. I just encourage you, Francis, to be there for her and to be supportive of her. And certainly if she asks you to do something specific, that if you're capable or able to do that, that you do it. But really focus on just being there for her and being a good listener, and let her know that you want to be there and that you count it a privilege, and as far as I'm concerned, a privilege to be there and be trusted by her as a person to talk to. And monitor your own feelings. And if you're starting to feel the anxiety about your best friend as if it was happening to you, then it might be good for you to have somebody to talk to. So who do you go talk to if that anxiety that your friend is feeling becomes overwhelming to you? So good luck, Francis. Be there for your friend and be a good listener. And my prediction is that at some point in the not too distant future, your friend is going to feel like you are maybe the person who was the most helpful to her, and her life is going to be better, and she'll find her new job, and she'll be well on her way, and she will remember that time very thankfully for the ways that you treated her and worked with her. So let's take a break here for a couple of minutes. We will come back and answer some other questions. We have a question here from Todd, who writes about the fact that he has just learned that his wife had been having an affair. And that's a pretty serious question, and we'll answer some things or talk about some things about that. Remember, you can write your questions to us at answers, A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at Andrews, Inc., A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C.net. That's answers at Andrews, Inc., .net. I am Dr. Rusty Andrews, a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and you are listening to Andrews Answers on Kanza Internet Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Anthony Perret, recording artist, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Music is one of the most important things in my life, but nothing is more important than life itself. So choose a designated driver. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
How I long to hear you sing beneath the clear blue skies.
A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council, the U.S. Department of Transportation, National Association of Broadcasters, and RAD.
Later, much later, we heard something. We didn't breathe for listening. Then footsteps on the back porch, creeping, then more confident. After all, nobody was home. A hand closed on the knob on the screen door to the kitchen and found it latched. We heard a little sawing sound as a file began to slice through the screen wire. Grandma reached down for something in her sewing basket. Through the darkness, I managed to notice Grandma's rocker was rocking and she wasn't in it. She was standing over me. "Keep just behind me," she whispered. I followed her across the room into the kitchen. Now we were by the door, and I heard the scuffle of heavy feet in there on the crinkly linoleum. Grandma turned back to me. Under my nose, she struck a wooden match with her thumbnail. She touched the match to something in her other hand. It sizzled. Then she leaned down and rolled it into the invisible kitchen. Explore new worlds. Find out what happens next by reading the book A Long Way from Chicago by Richard Peck. For other great book ideas, visit literacy.gov. A message from the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Science Today. And we already have our next caller. Welcome. Who's this?
Hi, I'm Philip.
Hello, Philip. You sound really young.
Not really. I'm 9.
Oh, wow. You're still in elementary school, right?
Does that matter?
Oh, no, not at all. What's your question?
Well, I know the molecular formula for water is H2O. I also know that hydrocarbon is CH3CH250CH3. Glucose is C6H12O6. The general formula for an alkene is CnH2n+2. But what I can't seem to find is any scientific formula for Bob.
Bob?
My goldfish.
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
Welcome back to Andrews Answers. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. And we are here to talk about life's questions answered on Kanza Internet Radio. You can send a question in by email, by emailing to answers@andrewsinc.net. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, and you can check us out on the Kanza Internet Radio page at Kanza Radio, that's K-O-N-Z-A Radio, .org. And at KanzaRadio.org, you'll find lots of other programs that you can listen to that appear here on Kanza Internet Radio, as well as archives of our past programs and the other past programs. So you can listen to any program you'd like at any time you would like. And we appreciate you listening right now to Andrew's Answers here on Kanza Internet Radio. Todd wrote us a rather sad note and said that I found out last week that my wife had been having an affair. She says it ended months ago, but I discovered some pictures on her phone of this other guy, and I asked her about them, and she confessed. She says she wants to stay married to me, but I'm confused. Is there any hope? Well, when people have experienced that kind of a situation, that question of is there any hope and what should I do is a really important one, Todd, and it's one that it's hard to answer, and no therapist actually can answer that for you, but a therapist can certainly help with whatever rebuilding process is available. Therapists are bound ethically not to make decisions for clients and tell them what to do. But I always tell my clients that I do have a bias, and that bias is toward marriage. And if there's something that we can do that would be helpful, that could help their marriage survive, then I'm all for doing that. On the other hand, I'm completely aware that there are situations that arise and in certain marriages that really divorce seems to be probably the most appropriate answer. And I certainly don't discourage people from following that avenue. But if there is a possibility that two people can work out their relationship and build it to something that's much better than it was before, then I'm all for that happening. And particularly, of course, all for that happening when there are kids involved. Children do tend to do better if they grow up in a happy home that has two parents, and having two parents is just, you know, I've talked to a lot of single parents, and that's just a very hard and overwhelming job. So having two parents there to bounce things off of each other and to be supportive of each other when that happens is a very good thing for kids. And they do very well in those situations. Kids that grow up with single parents can do very well, too, and can do better, actually, than kids that grow up, at least according to some studies, in highly conflicted homes. And so growing up in a single-parent home as opposed to a highly conflicted home can actually be better. But, you know, the ultimate is if somebody can have two parents and grow up with both of them, and the mom and dad can be happy with each other, then that is the ideal. So that's just an explanation from my perspective as why I sort of do tell people that I do have a bias toward marriage, and I like to help people work that out if there's any way that it is possible, while acknowledging the fact that sometimes it isn't, and the better thing to do is to move on and then talk about how to do that moving on. In any case, Todd, specifically in this situation, it is kind of similar to the email that Francis sent in earlier in this way, and that is that you are going through a period of grief. No matter what happens with your marriage at this point, you have the loss of what you thought you had in your marriage relationship. That's where that confusion is coming from. And dealing with your grief is an important thing to do. And with the, maybe I should say even more broadly, just the emotions that you're having in this situation. In your particular situation, I note that your wife has had months to process through, to think about this situation, to make a decision about what she wants, to make a decision about your marriage. She apparently, from at least what she said in that stressful time of being found out and confessing her affair, has said that she wants to stay married. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that that particular decision isn't going to change. But on the other hand, dealing with what's going on has been something that she's had months to do. And if, in fact, it was months ago that the affair ended, she's had months to deal with the fact that it happened, that she did it, and that she or the other person has ended it. And you've just had a few days. So you're not going to be as far along in dealing with this as she is, and you need to give yourself some time to just emotionally, as much as from a cognitive decision-making perspective, to emotionally process through and deal with this, deal with the emotions that you're having. I would recommend to you that you, if it's at all possible for you, that you and your wife really make no decisions right now about whether you are or are not going to stay married. I will often tell people that, you know, there really is no reason, there's no deadline here for you to make a decision. So maybe it's better if you, in this emotional state, put off the whole idea of making major life-changing decisions. There's been enough decisions that have gone on here that have turned into something that isn't very happy, something that is really painful. So maybe that whole decision-making process needs to slow down. And I've yet to actually have somebody who was a client who came up with some reason why a decision needed to be made in any short period of time, unless, of course, their spouse is already deciding that they're done with the marriage, and in that case, the decisions are fairly limited anyway. But, you know, there's probably no need for you to be deciding anything and trying to be unconfused. That may sound a little strange, but in some ways, maybe staying where you're at in that emotional place where you're a little bit confused isn't such a bad place to be right now. In dealing with your emotions, you have the grief. You probably have the anger. You probably have questions of why did this happen, or how could she do this to me, or what has she done to me, or feelings of being embarrassed. You're the old term, you're the cuckold in this situation. You're the one who didn't have the affair, and you're dealing with that. And you may be embarrassed because you think other people know about it. I would encourage you just to be spending some time processing through those emotions, and again, not making decisions based upon them right now at this point in time. You've got those emotions, and having somebody that you can talk to about them, whether it's a therapist or a very close trusted friend, would be a really good idea, and you being willing to express those, and at the same time realizing that they are emotions and they're not going to last forever. Sometimes we have emotions that only last seconds, but they are emotions that you will not feel as strongly at some point in the future, but it's important to be able to express them. Just like in the situation with Frances and her best friend and dealing with grief, the ability to verbally express your emotions is a very good human human characteristic, and being able to do that can help you actually work your way through them. So take the time that you need to just sort of call a stop to everything and not make any decisions. At some point, you'll want to start working on the marriage and the relationship you're having. I would anticipate that would take some amount of time, and it's going to take some amount of work. But when you start to do that, it will be about more than just the affair. Affairs are a thing that happens, but relationships are something that are based upon a lot of other issues besides just those kinds of behaviors. Affairs don't have to be the end of marriages. I know there are some people that say that, you know, if my spouse did that, that I would never be able to forgive them and I'd never be able to move on, and it would be the reason that we would get a divorce. There wouldn't even be any question about it. But I can say that there are many, 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 many marriages that are able to move past those kinds of situations and that are actually stronger. Now, I'm not recommending that couples have affairs just so that they can strengthen their marriage. I'm just saying that if it's happened, it is possible to have a marital relationship that's much stronger than it was before. But making it stronger is going to likely be about more than just the affair. It won't be not about the affair, but it won't be just about the affair. One of the things that I think, from my perspective, that needs to happen is for the person who is the, some people call them the offended person or the person who did not have the affair, is for them to make a decision about how much they want to know. In my way of looking at it, I think that that person is in charge of making that decision about how much they want to know. But I also recommend that they are very, very, very careful in making that decision, that things known can rarely be unknown. And so once you've asked a question and it's been answered about an affair, you can't unanswer that question. And I think it's important for you to make a decision, Todd, about how much you do want to know. I think part of the healing process is your wife building trust in herself by you by being willing to respond to those questions. And her willingness to respond to those questions is a way that you can learn to trust her, learn that she is serious about being open to you about what happened. But everybody's different. I've never known two people to be exactly the same in terms of what they did want to know or what they didn't want to know. And that's why, because of the fact you can't unknow it, is why I say that it's important to make a very clear and unemotional decision. How is it going to be if you know this or don't know this, and how will it make you behave differently? How will it make you think differently? And what difference will it make to you? So that decision is an important one. Another thing I want to talk about is the idea of differentiating between trust and forgiveness. I think that there are a lot of people who think of the idea of forgiveness as being one that means I'm going to say, oh, it's okay. And you know, when you're a little kid and you say, I'm sorry, and then the other little kid says to you, oh, that's okay. Well, I don't really think of that as a true reflection of what forgiveness is all about. In fact, forgiveness is not about saying something is okay. If something was okay, you wouldn't need to ask for forgiveness in the first place. So I think forgiveness is not about telling something that someone's okay. I've had people say to me, you know, I could never forgive him for what he did to me because it would be like saying it's all right that he did it, and it's not. And my response to that is, well, of course it's not all right that he did it. It will never be all right that he did it. That's not what forgiving is about. Forgiving, from my perspective, and influenced from my background, of course, is that forgiveness is something you do because if you don't do it, you're holding on to that thing in your heart, and it's tearing you up more than it maybe tears up anyone else. So forgiveness is something that you do because that's what's best for you. Now, another thing I hear are things like, well, I couldn't forgive him because I could never trust him. And my response to that is that forgiveness and trust are two very, very different things. Forgiveness, again, is this thing that you do so that you're letting this thing go from inside you so that it doesn't bother you anymore. But trust is the observation of someone's behavior over time and learning what to expect their behavior to do. So if someone does something that's inappropriate to you or that affects you, you're not going to trust them. And you shouldn't expect to trust them because you've observed their behavior and they've behaved in an untrustworthy manner. And so your building of trust in them is not going to be something that happens instantaneously. It's something that happens over time as you observe their behavior. That's harkens back to that thing I was saying about what do you want to know and your wife being willing to answer your questions about that so that your curiosity, once you've truly made a decision about what those things are, has been satisfied. But her openness then shows an ability to act and behave in a trustworthy way, even when it brings pain to her. And so there is a difference between trust and forgiveness, and forgiveness is something you do to because it has an impact on you, and trust is something that is based upon the observation of someone else's behavior over time. There is one other thing to think about, and that is there is a way of looking at affairs that when a person has an affair in a marriage that is not something they did to the other person. It's something they did to themselves. They expressed themselves and who they are, and they didn't paint a very pretty picture of who they are. But it isn't something they did to you. It certainly has an effect on you, and Todd, I know in your case, you're feeling the confusion and the pain, the sorrow about your marriage because of your wife's confession of her affair. But if you can, and sort of an existentialist perspective, but if you can look at that as not something she did to you, but something that she really did to herself, then I think that might be a very, very, very helpful thing for you to think through and a helpful way for you to begin to look at it and to be able to let some of the pain that's going on inside of you go. The idea of getting past an affair, I'm not sure that people really get past them. It's more of being able to deal with the consequences of the affair and finding that the need to deal with those consequences becomes less and less over time. But I remember one person telling me that getting past something was kind of scary because it was always behind them and that could always sneak up and grab them from behind, and they wanted to find a way to sort of set it off to the side so they could check on it from time to time and realize that it was not in a position to hurt them. So I think in therapy and certainly marital counseling that you'll be working toward a better marriage. And if the answer to the question of is there any hope, there is absolutely hope. And I know many, many, many couples who have been in the situation you're in and who have tremendous relationships now. So yes, there is hope, and it is going to be something that takes a lot of work. But the work is probably well worth it if you and your wife are both willing to participate in that. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. This has been Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered. Remember that you can send us your questions by emailing to answers@andrewsinc.net. Follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, and check us out at the Konza Internet Radio webpage at konzaradio.org. Andrew's Answers is produced by Megan Andrews. This is Dr. Rusty Andrews, licensed clinical marriage and family therapist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and you're listening to Konza Internet Radio.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.